Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, February 12th. I hate to start the show with the words, none of this might matter, but none of the dramatic revelations about the January 6th insurrection coming out at the impeachment trial might matter to the outcome. Some of them are genuinely new this week. Some of them are just new to a lot of people's awareness. But we're going to go over a few, and then we'll talk to former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara and see what he thinks about these and other things. The biggest new thing, to my eye, is that even if you've decided that former President Trump didn't originally incite the insurrection, once he was back at the White House, knowing it was taking place and taking place on his behalf, he may have egged it on in a new way than previously understood. He certainly didn't demand that the rioters cease and desist. At very least, he watched it on TV as a very interested observer without immediately trying to make it stop. We knew that. But there is new evidence that emerged Wednesday night that Trump may have tweeted an attack on Mike Pence after he learned that Pence was in danger in a phone call with Alabama Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville. Now, Tuberville revealed that he became aware that the vice president was being escorted to safety while he, Tuberville, was on the phone with Trump and told Trump that right as he was learning it, right as Pence was being escorted to safety or just after it. As Politico reports it, the existence of the phone call had been previously reported, but the detail that Tuberville informed Trump his vice president was in danger is a new and potentially significant development for House prosecutors seeking Trump's conviction. It occurred just around the time that Trump sent a tweet attacking Pence for not having, quote, the courage to unilaterally stop Joe Biden's victory. That from Politico. So what's this timeline? Well, Pence was removed from the Senate chamber at 2:14 p.m. Trump's tweet attacking Pence came about 10 minutes later. So if Senator Tuberville was on the phone with Trump as Pence was being removed, and Tuberville was telling Trump that at that moment, wow, could even Donald Trump have been that heartless and self-interested as to tweet an attack on Pence afterwards? So in the impeachment arguments yesterday, Democratic Congressman Joe Neguse of Colorado seemed to refer in his closing remark to that fact.
The fact that he actually further inflamed the mob, attacking his vice president while assassins were pursuing him in this Capitol, more than requires conviction and disqualification. We humbly ask you to convict President Trump for the crime for which he is overwhelmingly guilty of. Because if you don't, if we pretend this didn't happen, or worse, if we let it go unanswered, who's to say it won't happen again?
Democratic Congressman Joe Neguse of Colorado in his closing remarks shortly before the end of the House impeachment manager's presentation to the Senate yesterday. And let's start there with Preet Bharara, former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, which is fancy Justice Department speak for Manhattan and the northern suburbs up to around Poughkeepsie and the Catskills. He was appointed by Obama, famously invited to remain in the job by Trump until Trump fired him, and has since gone on to teach law at NYU, launch a podcast called Stay Tuned with Preet, and write a book called Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. And now there's a podcast version of the book being launched, so you can read or listen to Doing Justice. And Preet, always great to have you here. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be here.
Can we start with that Tommy Tuberville phone call revelation? Have you seen the details of that enough to draw a conclusion about the timeline, about whether Trump tweeted against Pence after he knew Pence was in danger in the Capitol? I'm not sure quite how buttoned down that timeline is.
Yeah, it's not perfectly buttoned down. And you saw there was an objection made by Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee from Utah, about the veracity of what was reported about the call, the mistaken call. But even if you don't have that timeline perfectly buttoned down, I think the House managers did a great job of showing just how callous Donald Trump was to the plight not only of his vice president, but every member of Congress, even after the attack was underway, even after it's clear he knew that it was violent, even after he knew that members of his own staff, current staff, former staff, were all clamoring for him to tamp it down. I think that's powerful evidence of his guilt in impeachment overall, even if that particular timeline is not 100% perfectly buttoned down.
And Preet, as everyone has said a million times, this is not a court of law with a real impartial jury. It's a political process with senators with their own interests. But even in that context, if it's further proven that Trump egged on the insurrectionists with anti-Pence tweets or other things, how could none of this matter and people vote to acquit the president of incitement of insurrection?
Well, you should maybe have on instead of me, who I think is a reasonable observer of the facts, and instead have on some Republican senators and ask them how they in good conscience can vote against conviction. I mean, one of the things that I expect that you'll ask me and that was making a lot of news last night was, apart from all the other conflicts, that some of these jurors, all these jurors are in fact arguably victims. Some of them may be complicit themselves. They're all certainly witnesses because they were in the, many of them were in the Capitol at the time. But you have these reports that three Republican senators were actually meeting with the defense team. And, lots of people are throwing up their hands and saying, can you imagine jurors meeting with the defense lawyers about their strategy in a traditional trial? And no, right. You can't.
It was
Lindsey Graham
and two others. But is it, I did scratch my head at that story, but I also wondered, well, are the House impeachment managers who were Democrats not having any communication with Democratic senators who are also from their side going on TV and seeming like they've made up their minds?
Yeah. Well, I saw some senator from the Democratic side, Dick Durbin, I think, last night on television saying that that's not happening. So, that's his assertion. I guess the only point I would make is there are a million things that cause, a rash of conflicts in this proceeding. Like I said, the jurors are their witnesses, their victims, their accomplices in many cases. We don't know what the standard of proof is. We don't know what the elements of the crime are. Everyone has a different version of what they think their duty is. But in order to show, some kind of rational amount of fairness and neutrality, even though it's not a regular trial, there's some things that I think are more glaring than other things. And so, brazenly meeting with the defense lawyers to help them with their strategy seems like a little bit of a bridge too far, even though it doesn't cause a mistrial. There's no sanction. You can basically do anything in this proceeding and the trial will go on.
One of the things that I gather the Republican or the Trump defense team will argue, this is speculation that I saw on Fox, is that you can't convict the president of incitement to insurrection just because some people interpreted his words as incitement to insurrection if he wasn't being direct about it. So, for example, MSNBC yesterday was highlighting text messages and defendant testimony from alleged rioters in cases where they're the defendants. And they presented, for example, text from an accused rioter, allegedly from the militia group, the Oath Keepers, someone named Jessica Watkins, a military veteran. She texted in November, unless the POTUS himself activates us, it's not legit. The POTUS, President of the United States, Trump, has the right to activate units too, units. And then on December 29th, she texted, we plan on going to D.C. on the 6th. Trump wants all able-bodied patriots to come on. Of course, able-bodied, you know, suggests they're going to engage in something physical. And she wrote, if Trump activates the Insurrection Act, I'd hate to miss it, unquote. So she obviously didn't think he'd invoke the Insurrection Act against the insurrectionists, but maybe against some other groups who maybe they hope to draw in. I don't know. But it certainly tells us that people interpreted Trump's words from November on when he was saying, this is a stolen election and I won by a landslide and I'll never concede, as an invitation to commit an insurrection. But does that prove that Trump made one?
I think it's part of the context. I think it's part of the story. If you say something and lots of people, not just one or two people at the margin, but lots and lots of people interpret it as a call to arms and a call to action, I think that's relevant to the proof. Obviously, the most relevant proof that the House managers did a good job of marshaling is, you know, what Trump said and what was in the mind of Trump as to his expectations and his foreseeability and the foreseeability of the idea that people would be engaging in violent action. And you had plenty of that. I mean, people forget that this is not just about the speech he made in the late morning, early afternoon of January 6th. As much as his lawyers want to make that the narrow focus of the impeachment trial, it's about everything that went on for a long time. And the signs of violence go way back. You know, one of the House managers, I think, did a great job of talking about Donald Trump's reaction when supporters of his, some of whom also participated in the insurrection on January 6th, tried to run a Biden-Harris bus off the highway, a violent act that Donald Trump not only laughed off, but then retweeted about it in a positive light. There was the Georgia official, election official, who said by perpetuating this big lie that the election was stolen from Donald Trump is going to get somebody killed. And he was right. I could go on and on. I don't want to repeat the entire House manager's presentation. Yeah. But time after time after time, Donald Trump understood that perpetuating this big lie was going to cause people to be violent. His supporters had been violent. He had encouraged their violence. He's never condemned their violence. And so when you ask them to come at a particular time, on a particular day, for purposes of overturning an election, it's I think it's very clear that his words made the difference.
And there were things that came out from the House impeachment managers' mouths that were for emotional impact and to increase the outrage, the sense of victimhood that people, you know, certain people who may not even have been the members of Congress were forced to experience, like Senator Chris Coons. Again, I did not see this in a House manager's presentation, but I guess it was there because I saw Senator Coons talking about this on TV, referring to how black House custodians, Capitol custodians, had to clean up blood and feces left by white supremacist rioters. That's maybe part of a victim impact statement if you were in a regular court of law. And there's evidence that was presented, as I understand it, that the plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, which was foiled by the FBI, was a dress rehearsal for January 6th. So all of those things might matter to a jury. I'm curious how frustrating for you it is as a former prosecutor, where it really is about the law and impartial jury, to see what looks like a trial but is really just politics.
Yeah, this is the second time around. So I think maybe as a personal matter, I got the frustration out the first time around. And I did a bunch of writing and speaking about how different from an actual trial it is. But it makes sense. I think it makes even more sense in this context. that it be a political act. I mean, this is what the founders, you know, wanted to have happen. When you have an abuse of power by the head of one branch of government, the president, you know, maybe a court of law is not up to the task of dealing with it. It still may, because there's still criminal conduct that could be prosecuted. But if you're talking about the sanction of not just removal, but disqualification from future holding office, which a criminal case can't accomplish, it makes some sense that a co-equal branch of government in political fashion, given the constitutional crisis, is the body that makes the decision to check and balance that other branch of government. And it's frustrating, and you know, there's lots of things that seem unfair if you're considering it to be a traditional criminal trial or even civil trial. But you know, the crisis is a political one, not necessarily a criminal one.
Jacob in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my phone call. It's an honor to speak to you, Mr. Baraha. I had a question I'd like your thoughts on. We all try to be, you know, impartial and open-minded to both the defense and the prosecution. And I know one of the points that the defense is going to make is that politicians always dial up the temperature, and we don't generally hold politicians responsible for their supporters once they dial up the temperature. Like Bernie Sanders said that Republicans are going to kill your grandmother. He's not responsible for his supporters shooting up a congressional baseball game. Barack Obama, President Obama, said that the police are systematically racist. He's not responsible for his supporter shooting 6 cops in Texas. Or when Maxine Waters says that her supporters should actively, physically confront people who she disagrees with politically. So I'd like your opinion, Mr. Baraha, on what exactly is the difference between what President Trump said and politicians always, you know, saying, you know, didn't Governor Cuomo say that they, you know, we should beat up something about that's just how a tough New Yorker talks. If Donald Trump walks down the streets of New York, you know, we'll show him something about how real New Yorkers fight. What's your perspective on the difference between what President Trump said and people always dialing up the political, you know, the rhetoric and the temperature?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and it's a matter of degree, and it's a matter of the amount of time someone said something, the context, the amount of warnings people have gotten, and you know, those are interesting examples that you point out. They seem to be one-offs with respect to those particular politicians. In Donald Trump's case, it was over and over and over and over again. As I said, there were examples of violence that he knew about, that he condoned, that he didn't condemn. He had an understanding because the executive branch and law enforcement officers knew that people were coming to the Capitol on January 6th, preparing to engage in violence. And not only that, Donald Trump, as the House managers argued, had something to do with the choosing of the date. Initially, they were going to be having some kind of protest on January 21st or 22nd. That seems to have been moved at the urging of Donald Trump to January 6th, the date that the counting of the ballots was taking place in the Congress. and then he had some role, according to the House managers, in changing the route so that they could march to the Capitol. And then after the event happens and it's underway, as Brian began the interview, instead of expressing remorse, instead of calling them on them to stop, instead of trying to protect his vice president, he seemed to rejoice in this idea that people were engaging in violence at his behest and trying to overturn the election. He didn't do much of anything for 2 or 3 hours. Later in the evening, he told these people who had engaged in this violence, who had threatened his vice president, "I love you. You're patriots." So it's the combination. I take your point, but it's the combination of comments and statements and warnings that he ignored, plus his conduct that day, plus his conduct after the events happened, I think all lead to the unassailable conclusion that he incited.
And Jacob, thank you for your well-framed question. We'll see if the Trump defense team does as good a job this afternoon of likely trying to make that same point in an argument that relates to your question. Call us again. And to that point, and anticipating that exact argument today, kind of the free speech argument, First Amendment argument, Democratic House Manager Jamie Raskin of Maryland yesterday cited Voltaire, the 18th century French philosopher, in arguing that Trump's free speech is not a good defense for the way he riled up his supporters. Listen to this.
Voltaire said famously, and our founders knew it, "I may disagree with everything you say, but I will defend with my life your right to say it." President Trump says, "Because I disagree with everything you say, I will overturn your popular election and incite insurrection against the government." And we might take a moment to consider another Voltaire insight, which a high school teacher of mine told me when a student asked, "When was the beginning of the Enlightenment?" And she said, "I think it was when Voltaire said, 'Anyone who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities.'"
What a great Voltaire quote that I never heard before. Absurdities that can make you commit atrocities. He anticipated by a few hundred years what we have just witnessed.
Yeah, look, I thought that Jamie Raskin's preemption of the First Amendment argument was terrific and compelling and smart. And one of the other things he said is, you know, it's very easy for people to just throw out a slogan and mention an amendment to the Constitution. First Amendment, it's you know, unpopular political speech, as if, as Jamie Raskin said, as if the president of the United States was just some regular guy who did not have special power. And I thought the very compelling example he gave is, if a private citizen, if you or I, we might get, you know, in trouble with our peer group, but if you or I said, "We're swearing an oath of loyalty to another country," or started trashing America, or said, you know, it'd be one, Floyd Abrams, the famous and prominent First Amendment lawyer, was making this argument, this example on television the other night, and we said that it would be wonderful if China invaded the United States. Nothing would happen to you. I mean, you could be fired from WNYC. That's certainly true. But nothing would happen to us criminally. That's part of protected First Amendment speech. But now imagine that a president of the United States who was sworn an oath to faithfully execute the laws said those things, said, "I am loyal to Russia," or "I am loyal to China," or invited China to invade the United States. He would be impeached forthwith, and it would be fine. And I think it would be you know, much more bipartisan affair than this is. Presidents have a special duty to honor and respect the Constitution and to protect the country. And so just because something came out of the vocal cords and the mouth of a human who happens to be the president of the United States doesn't mean there's no consequence. People get fired from their jobs. And that's what this is, right? This is about removal from office or disqualification from future office. It's not about separation of a person from their liberty. It's not a criminal case. And as Jamie Raskin also pointed out, I thought compellingly, Donald Trump has fired a lot of people for things that they said. So there's really no, I think, argument here. It's just a lot of rhetoric on the part of Trump's lawyers.
And any statement from my mouth that Preparar even hypothetically attributes to me do not necessarily represent the views of this host or this radio station.
It was a hypothetical.
That's right. Just playing. Diego in Sunset Park. You're on WNYC with Preparar.
Thanks for taking my call, Brian. I don't think I'm being overly hyperbolic by saying this is an ongoing crime. I mean, you have state governments in Montana, in Arizona, I think in Georgia, who are censuring Republicans who have come out against the president. The governor who merely certified the election, he obviously from that phone call attacked Georgia's governor, attorney general, looking to find votes. I mean, these people are going to have consequences paid. If there's a next time, are they going to be as stalwart in their defense of truth when their careers are going to be ruined and their employment is going to be jeopardized? I mean, this is an ongoing crime, and I think it's too early to exhale to say we got over January 6th and now we just got to make him pay the piper. This is an ongoing crime, and the stage is being set for things in the future that might happen.
Diego, I'm going to move on for time and get a response. But he's exactly right, Preet, isn't he? For people who haven't followed these stories, at the state level, in some of the swing states, like Arizona, where the Republican governor who certified the election has been censured by the state Republican Party. Same thing in Michigan. The Board of Elections member, or whatever they call it, who was the swing vote to certify the election, has been replaced. So if we were exhaling, thinking, well, at least a lot of these Republican officials around the country, upheld the line for norms, maybe not next time.
Look, I think the caller is exactly right. And that is the reason why, in large part, the president of the United States, the former president, was impeached, even though there were only days left. Why do you do that? And the Republicans keep making the point, well, he's already left office. And the reason is, the reason for the speed and the alacrity is that he was an ongoing threat, because it is an ongoing crime. And they did it in 7 days. And the reason, even while he's out of office, although I think that's constitutional, and the argument is being made against it being constitutional, the reason they're still proceeding, even though he's out of office, is that it can happen again. And it's happening on an ongoing basis. And his supporters can still be riled up, and they can still be incited. So I think, the point of the caller, the spirit of the caller's question and comment, is exactly why we're here doing this thing, because Donald Trump remains a threat to the democracy that he was supposed to protect and to the American people.
Preet Bharara, his podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet, is ongoing. And the new one with stories from his book, Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law, is now being released. It's not all at once. This isn't binge on six stories from the book.
You can binge the first three. The first three Doing Justice episodes can be binged, and then the next three are coming up.
Preet, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.